You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
I'm happy to welcome Richard Lertzman back to the show this week. We last spoke a few years back when he published his outstanding biography of Mickey Rooney. And he's also the author of Beyond Columbo, The Life and Times of Peter Falk, Dr. Feelgood, The Shocking Story of the Doctor Who May Have Changed History by Treating and Drugging JFK, Marilyn, Elvis, and Other Prominent Figures. And his new book is called Deconstructing the Rat Pack, Joey, the Mob, and the Summit. Rick Lertzman, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary. Thanks for inviting me.
So this book is a biography of Joey Bishop, as well as a kind of cultural history of his times and his involvement with Sinatra and the Rat Pack, or the Summit, as Sinatra preferred.
The book's the story of the Rat Pack and how it was put together as a business proposition through the eyes of Joey Bishop, who we take from being a mob comic and becoming eventually the opening act for Frank Sinatra and falling into the right place at the right time, which is falling in with Frank Sinatra, Dean, and Sammy in 1960 for the Summit and the Rat Pack, which took Joey's career in a upswing for 10 years. And there was a big window for Joey until he kind of he burned a lot of bridges after that.
So the rapid rise and slow decline.
Yes.
Well, yep. There are probably lots of people listening who don't remember Joey Bishop. I do. I loved Joey Bishop a lot.
Right.
And he made me laugh. But tell us, who was Joey Bishop?
Joey Bishop was he came from Philadelphia, was born in about 1915, and he came off the streets. He was one of the wise guys in South Philadelphia, worked with a couple other guys, and they called themselves the Bishop Brothers. So in the 1930s, he worked a bunch of different clubs around Philadelphia and New Jersey and that area. Got to know guys in the mob who liked him. And he was brought to Cleveland in a club called El Dumpo. And the El Dumpo was run by the mafia, the guys who really, the monsters who really created Las Vegas, because it was the Cleveland Mafia. So it was guys like Mo Dalitz, who created the Sands Hotel and Desert Inn and built the convention center and Sunrise Hospital in Las Vegas. Max Diamond, who I happen to know. Mickey Cohn, who later became a powerhouse in Los Angeles. Billy Weinberger, who created Caesar's Palace later on. So he fell into the right place at the right time at the El Dumpo, where he knew how to keep his mouth quiet, keep his nose clean, and made the customers happy. Well, they went to the back room and gambled in casinos in those joints that he worked at. And so Joey really was a journeyman comic. That's what he became.
Yes. Well, you know, I think your book, and I enjoyed your book very much, and I recommend it to everybody listening, but I don't think you like Joey Bishop's, I don't think you like Joey Bishop as a comedian. I think you actually met him and interviewed him, right?
I met him quite a few times, and I knew him for a period of about 15, 20 years. As a comedian, I thought he was a journeyman. He was Morty Gunty. He was Corbett Monica. He was a journeyman, a good opening act. He didn't a good opening act for a guy like Frank Sinatra or Dean Martin or Sammy or people like that. They don't want the air sucked out of the room. They want someone who could just warm up the audience. Don't do too much and don't leave it open for them to hit all the big notes. And Joey did just that. He was a journeyman comic. And, you know, he came on to, he got his fame in the late 50s on Jack Parr. And he looked very witty and he came up with great responses. He also had great writers, which he didn't admit. He had guys like Gary Marshall and his writing partner. He had Don Sherman, whose daughter, Amy Sherman Palladino, creates Mrs. Maisel.
Oh, that's interesting.
He had some of the best writers, and he was smart enough to do that, but it wasn't Joey Bishop's great wit that really brought him that.
Of course, you know, Jack Benny famously said, You wouldn't say that if my writers were here when Fred Allen ad-libbed. So, I mean, many great comedians used great writers. That's not to say that they're not. I mean, I think that there are a lot of famous people who are famous for a period of time because they are. That's their moment.
Right.
And, you know, then as time goes by, people forget them. And, well, you know, let's say Edgar Bergen. Edgar Bergen was enormously talented and
right.
funny and terrific actor. I mean, he played the part of Charlie McCarthy and Mortimer's Nerd, you know. And today, because people don't listen to old radio programs, people have virtually forgotten Edgar Bergen. But that doesn't diminish the fact that he was terrifically talented. So the fact that we don't see Joey Bishop anymore, his classic talk show, as you point out in your book, there's no recordings or very few recordings of it. And his sitcom was not really his high point as a comedian. There is that little bit that you talk about in the book that I love, that little scene that he has in How to Save Your Marriage. Is that the mm-hmm. movie?
Right.
And that is hilarious. I love that. Although people today probably would be offended by it. So, I mean, I don't think that the fact that he's not well remembered doesn't mean that he wasn't talented. And also, many of the people who you talk to in your book don't like him and say mean things about him. But nobody liked Al Jolson, and many people say mean things about Jolson, but that doesn't diminish Jolson's terrific impact.
No.
So it's kind of subjective in terms of whether or not he was.
It's very subjective. He had, you know, some comedians, a lot of comedians did not like to admit, like Red Skelton and others who never like to admit they had writers.
Right.
They liked the people to think that it was them, and they diminished the writer's input. Jack Benny was one who did not. Jack Benny worshipped the writers, and he had guys like Milt Josephsberg. He had some great writers, as did Fred Allen, and Fred Allen respected the writers. Now, Fred Allen's forgotten because the bulk of his work was done on radio, and people don't remember Fred Allen was actually a very witty, great powerhouse on radio. And, you know, there were others like Fibber McGee and Molly, and there's a lot of people who are forgotten.
Joe Penner. You know,
Joey never respected his writers. But we talk about Milt Josephsberg. Milt was hired to be a writer for Joey on the Joey Bishop sitcom, which amazingly lasted for 4 years. And 140 or 50 episodes, which is remarkable for something that was like a kind of a hodgepodge. So Milt Josephsberg wrote an episode where Joey played his twin cousin. And Joey's like getting angrier and angrier during the week. And he's really angry. And finally he grabs Milt Josephsberg, who's this very diminutive, very quiet, mild-mannered writer who knew from Jack Benny, who Jack treated him like $1 million. Joey grabs this little man and starts shaking him. He goes, "How did you give all these great lines to my twin cousin?"
My twin is getting all the laughs.
He didn't grasp the idea that he's playing both parts. But so Joey burned so many bridges. I got a chance to talk to Gary Marshall, who, you know, was a brilliant comedy writer, because for years he wrote The Odd Couple, and then he wrote Laverne and Shirley and Happy Days and then films. But he started out on the Dick Van Dyke Show, but he started out on Joey Bishop. And his writing partner at the time just couldn't take Joey Bishop. And Gary saw it as a master's course in comedy, because he's working with Sheldon Leonard. He's working with Milt Josephsberg and Harry Crane. And the cream of the crop of the writers that work for the Danny Thomas, Sheldon Leonard studio. And so Gary Marshall stuck it out and learned how to do production and everything else for Joey. So, you know, it's Joey was lucky to have a lot of great writers all through the years. But because he burned a lot of bridges, at the end of his 10-year window of fame, he basically disappeared for the next almost 40 years.
The rest of his life. Yeah, yeah. And I suppose that, again, that's probably true of a lot of performers whose moment passes them by. I have one more little quibble with you then, Rick, if you don't mind. I mean, we're talking with Richard Lertzman, and his new book is called the deconstructing the Rat Pack, Joey, the Mob, and the Summit. So in your discussion of Joey as a maybe a mediocre talent, you compare him to another mediocre talent, George Gobel. And I think George Gobel is one of the most hilarious comics of all time. You know, I think a lot of people who, again, they don't know him because his later years, like the Hollywood Squares or something. But if you ever watch his early stuff, you can really see how Tommy Smothers based his entire bit on George Gobel. George Gobel had that same kind of delivery, and he played the guitar and sang funny songs. I love George Gobel, so I'm mad at you for
putting George Gobel had a very laid-back approach to it. He had that great line on Johnny Carson where he said, I feel like a brown pair of shoes. He's sitting with Dean Martin and Bob Hope, and he was... But George Gobel's another one who never respected the writer. His life on television in the 50s was very short-lived as a variety artist. I mean, he had about two or three or four good years, burned out a lot of writers. And on his own, you know, he was just kind of more like Joey, a journeyman comic who would work around a lot of towns. He was lucky he got Hollywood Squares, which gave him some exposure, but he fell into the same kind of, you know, it's not saying he wasn't technically a good comic and funny and had his moments, but he wasn't the Jack Benny. He wasn't the giants of comedy. And he's a veteran comic, like a Bob. I used in the book Bob Uecker as a veteran catcher. That's what, you know, to me, Joey Bishop was. He was a journeyman.
It's interesting that the discussion that we're having that not only great writers make great comedians, but those writers that embrace those comedians that embrace their writers and respect their writers have longer careers on television and radio and movies. That's interesting.
I think absolutely. You know, Lucy had some great writers. She had Bob Carroll and Madeline Davis for years, and Bob Weisskopf. She had some really talented writers that she kept around, and they had differences with Lucy, but they still worked with Lucy for nearly 25 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course she was the boss, right? She was the star of this show, but she owned the studio. So
she and Desi had Desi Liu, and you know, and I was able to take a class from Lucy out at New Cal Northridge. She taught a class in the late 70s.
Wow.
And she taught a comedy class. And so I was going to USC Film School, and I heard about this great class at Cal Northridge. So I would drive up twice a week, and it was, you know, the class had like about 120 people, but Lucy gave a dissertation on comedy, how she learned from Clyde Bruckman and Buster Keaton and all these great comics, and how she learned technically how to do it. But she was a very tough, kind of bitter older lady. And one time I asked her a question that she didn't like, and she just tossed her cigarette at me. I had to duck out of the way. But she knew what she wanted, but she was, you know, very set in her ways.
She was a hilarious comic who was a very serious person.
Yeah, she was. I think she was more of an actress who learned how to become, who learned comedy rather than being a comedian herself.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking tonight with Richard Lertzman. I'm so jealous of this guy because Richard Lertzman has interviewed some of the greatest stars, actors, performers of the 20th century, including a couple of the Three Stooges. He interviewed Bud Abbott of Abbott and Costello. He interviewed so many greats, including Joey Bishop, who is the subject of his latest book, which is called Deconstructing the Rat Pack, Joey, the Mob, and the Summit. Richard Lertzman is also the author of Mickey Rooney, His Life and Times, Beyond Columbo, The Life and Times of Peter Falk, and Dr. Feelgood, The Shocking Story of the Doctor Who May Have Changed History by Treating and Drugging JFK, Marilyn, Elvis, and Other Prominent Figures.
Richard Lertzman, when you read your books, both this one and your Mickey Rooney book, you have all these interviews with people, and they're interviews with people who died a long time ago, or who couldn't have possibly contacted over this book. I mean, you talked with Mary Wicks or whoever. How do you happen to know all these people? And tell me, who else have you interviewed? Who are some of the people you've talked to?
I come from Cleveland, Ohio, and I went to USC Film School. So I started in the 1973. I'm 64. And the first people I got to know was Mo Howard, who was my uncle had a store called Lertzman Appliance, and his biggest client was Larry Fine, who lived in the area that his store was located. And Larry brought in Mo and his brother Shemp and even Curly at the time. So my father got to go out and see the Stooges. So I begged my uncle to introduce me to Mo, and I got to stay at Mo's house. He lived in near North Hollywood. I think he lived in Toluca Lake at the time. And I had a chance to stay with Mo, and Mo introduced me to Bud Abbott at the Motion Picture Home.
Wow.
And I got to meet Babe London, and Gene Hagen was at the Motion Picture Home at the time. And so I always carried around a little recorder, and I got to know over the years going to USC Film School, I would hunt out. I got to know George Cukor. I interviewed Mae West at her Ravenwood apartment, which was like an experience in itself, just meeting Mae West and seeing her. She was elderly. She was about 4'10", I think, maybe. Yeah. And it was a cult, but it was such, when I met George Cukor at his house, I was more excited to see Grady Sutton, who was this great actor from W.C. Fields and all the films.
Ogilvy.
Yeah. And so I just hunted out all the old.
Grady Sutton, was that George Cukor's house?
He lived with George. He was, he had a longtime relationship off and on with George
Cukor. Oh, I did not know that. That's very interesting.
And I got to have lunch with George Cukor, who introduced me to Mae West. So it was one to another. And I exploited I just wanted to meet these people. I met Jules White, who created the Three Stooges, and his brothers, Sam and Jack. I got to meet Christine McIntyre, who was a character actor in the Three Stooges. So I really hunted them out and taped them. And I have other friends who have done the same thing. Steve Cox, who writes a lot of books, did the same thing. And I have a lot of friends who have kind of gone that same route. But so I spent a lot of years interviewing a lot of people from that generation. I mean, it wasn't my generation, but I was fascinated, especially with the comedy performers from that era. So I got to talk to a lot of them. And I got to know Joey Bishop I knew him for about 30 years, but I knew him really well for the last 15 years of his life. And he was a very bitter, tough guy. He lived up in Newport Beach. He lived in it's called Lido Isle. It was a kind of a condo development up there. It was on the marina where he had a boat called Son of a Gun 2. And so he thought he was under the illusion that he was the hub, the center of the Rat Pack. And I went in knowing, you're not the center of the Rat Pack. The Rat Pack is Frank Sinatra, and then it's Dean and Sammy. And he would tell me stories about, you know, his work with the mobsters. We had a connection because I actually knew the people that he was talking about. I knew I had met Mickey Cohn, who had stayed at my parents' house, you know, which is another story in itself. I interviewed Mo Dalitz, who came from Cleveland and was a family friend. Because in those days, it's not, you didn't have to be in the mafia, but your businesses were kind of connected, and they were actually businessmen who ran restaurants. So what I was fascinated with was how the Rat Pack was put together. And I went to the UNLV archives, which has the archives of this great PR man. And there was a blueprint of putting together the Rat Pack to really put Las Vegas on the map. And Mo Dalitz was part of it. Frank Sinatra was part of it, who owned 9% of the Sands. The two PR men from the Sands Hotel were part of it. Jack and Trotter, who came from Copacabana in New York to run the Copa Room, was part of it. And a cousin of mine who was the president of the Sands, his name was Carl Cohn. And it was fascinating to see that Frank put together this really brilliant package with them to create the summit. And it wasn't necessarily going to be Frank. It was going to be Dean and Sammy and Peter. It just, and Joey, it fell into place that Frank had just done a film with Dean Martin called Some Come Running and became very close to Dean Martin. He had just nursed Sammy back to health after Sammy lost his eye in an auto accident. And Sam, and really Frank really nursed him back, to fought him back to dance again and to really get back on stage. Joey was his opening act. And Peter came to him with a script he found from a guy named George Clayton Thomas, who was a gas station attendant, who later became one of the great science fiction writers. And the script was a caper flick in Las Vegas, a heist flick, that George Clayton Thomas thought up from his experiences in the Army, and being in kind of the black market, and bringing back his crew and doing a caper in Las Vegas. So Frank
tell us what Frank said when he read the script.
Yeah, Peter tried to sell the script unsuccessfully with Peter in the lead, and finally he came to Frank, and Frank knew that Peter was now married to Patricia Kennedy. So after Peter had kind of backstabbed him with Ava Gardner, and he was on the outs with Frank, Frank reapproached with Peter, and Peter tried to sell him this script called Ocean's 11. So Frank saw the opportunity. He had a deal with Warners and Jack Warner to do this film. He saw an opportunity to mix the film, making the film, and also doing this gigantic 28-day summit. And the summit, you know, the Rat Pack people think of is this long-term, it still resonates today, but it really was only for 1 year. It was starting in February of 1960, and it really ended with Ocean's 11. And I mean, and they made films like Sergeant's Three, and they made Robin and the Seven Hoods, but the Rat Pack, the air was out of it, and it was that 1 year, that 28-day event that really resonates in everybody's senses to this day.
We like to think of them hanging out. But yeah, so when Frank read the script for Ocean's 11, according to your book, he said, rather than make the movie.
Frank read the book, you know, and he wasn't really close to Peter Lawford, but Frank sought power, and he saw a chance with Peter Lawford, getting in with Peter Lawford, that he can kind of get to know the Kennedys. And that's what Frank saw. And Joe Kennedy saw through Peter Lawford that he was a son-in-law. I'm sorry. I have a coming in Frank Sinatra of all things.
There he is.
He saw through Peter Lawford a chance to get to know the Kennedy boys and to know Jack Kennedy. And Joe Kennedy was one of the great promoters of all time. He had done it back with FBO Studios in the 20s, and then RKO. He created RKO, and he knew how to do film. He knew how to mix. He knew what was popular, and he wanted a chance to put his son in the spotlight, not to look like Richard Nixon, not to be the stodgy, old-fashioned politician. He wanted Jack to be this very cool, hip guy that resonates to the younger voters. And he saw a chance with the Rat Pack to do that. So he got Peter to really ingratiate himself with Frank to get Jack in the center spotlight during the summit in 1960.
And Frank said, let's forget the movie. Let's just pull the job.
That's right. Because it was a great concept of robbing seven casinos. And it was a fascinating film, and they got a chance to shoot it in Las Vegas. Before that, Vegas had seen Danny Thomas had done On Location, his Danny Thomas show from the Sands Hotel. Ooh. And the Sands all of a sudden saw this great upsurge in reservations at the Sands and at the Desert Inn and at the El Rancho and at all the hotels. So they saw that mixing television would probably bring them customers from the East, because most of their customers in Las Vegas came from Los Angeles. So this, they thought, they saw this as a chance to really get nationwide exposure. And that's where they said, let's put our money into this summit and let's try to get a film done here. And that's what Ocean's 11 was.
Well, we're talking, Richard Lertzman, about the people you've interviewed and met. And you've also talked to a couple times, I guess, to Donald Trump, who later became president of the United States. Well, what was your take on Donald Trump?
I had known Donald for a few years. I'd gone to a party with him. My wife and I went with Melania and Donald at Feinstein's. Had a 90th birthday party of Mickey Rooney. And so I got a chance to meet Melania and him. This is in 2010. So when I went to do the Mickey Rooney book, through a friend of mine named Ellen Easton, we arranged to go to his office in Trump Tower. And I got a chance to interview him then. And then afterward, when I met him, he's a very, very, very different than he appears on as president. He's a Wharton School of Graduates, a school, a finance graduate, fairly intelligent, fairly funny, loved show business, was an investor in Seinfeld, and was invested in a lot of plays on Broadway, including Sugar Babies and the Will Rogers Follies, which had his ex-wife. So different. Not my style of politics, but and at the time, and I can say this now because he's leaving office, at the time I was doing the interview, Donald said, you know, I'm running for president. And I said, why would you want to put yourself under the microscope? And you have such a great life. Why would you want to do that? And he looked at me and he said, it's good for the brand. And at that point, I believed that he had no desire to be president. He just wanted to sell. He was doing The Apprentice at that time, and he just wanted to sell the Trump hotels and The Apprentice and Miss Universe pageant. And he just thought it was a lark that he would just enjoy. And I think somehow it steamrolled and he became president.
Yep.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf. We're talking this week with Richard A. Lertzman. His new book is called Deconstructing the Rat Pack, Joey, the Mob, and the Summit. And the Joey is comedian Joey Bishop. Before we get back to our conversation with Richard Lertzman, let's listen to a little vintage Joey Bishop monologue.
I'm very happy to be here in Los Angeles. I'll tell you that. You people know how to live. You can't beat your freeways. I'll tell you that. Boy, it's wonderful. The underpasses, the overpasses, the cloverleaf intersections. I don't care where you live in Los Angeles. You hop in your car, get on any freeway, and in 15 minutes, you're lost. Well, I just came from Las Vegas, Nevada, and I'm very, very excited. I had a very good fortune of having worked there with some wonderful guys. And I was thrilled because my name was up there with them. Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, Sammy Davis Jr., Peter Lawford, and way on the bottom was my name. Only tall dogs knew I was working there. So when we finished, the big thrill was that Jack Entrada, who books the shows at the Sands, he gave us all gifts. And we never expected anything like that. Frank Sinatra got a beautiful wristwatch, and Peter Lawford got a sweater. I got a set of golf clubs. Sammy Davis Jr. got a camera. And Dean Martin got a cigarette lighter and emptied it in one gulp. It was just beautiful. And there's a lot of talk, you know, that Dean drinks a lot. That's not true. That's just publicity. Dean, as a matter of fact, is on a wonderful health kick. He takes very good care of himself. He has a beautiful home and a pool. And every morning he's up at 7 o'clock and takes his customary plunge right down the stairs. It's a wonderful feeling. So when you hear that stuff, and they have beautiful homes here, I'll tell you that. Sammy Davis has a gorgeous home. I went out and visited him. The landscaping, the shrubbery and the trees. See, I come from Philadelphia, and I lived in row houses. We never saw that, you know, shrubbery and trees. So if ever, the good Lord willing, I ever become a star and I move to California, I'm going to get a home with lots of trees, because I realize now that a house without a tree ain't fit for a dog. And, you know, so you look on.
Oh, that was Joey Bishop, the subject of a new book called Deconstructing the Rat Pack, Joey, the Mob, and the Summit. And the author is my guest, Richard Lertzman.
Rick Lertzman, all of your books kind of overlap. And I guess that's because of the interviews that you have to work from. But I mean, you know, Mickey Rooney appears in this book, and Joey Bishop and Mickey Rooney both appear in Sugar Babies, and Dr. Feelgood appears in this book. I mean, there's an overlapping, you know, do you have a sort of a grand scheme of things that you're writing about?
Well, I'm doing, my next book is on Jerry Lewis, who I got to know over the years.
Oh yeah.
And
Jerry Lewis was knew a lot of the mob people too.
Jerry had an interesting career. I'm fascinated with a lot of performers who have a great body of work. Mickey Rooney had it from 1926 to 2014.
Yeah.
Jerry Lewis was in the late 40s till he passed away a couple of years ago. So I love the interaction, and I like to take a look through the history of the business, and kind of, it gives me a chance to explore a lot of different avenues using Mickey Rooney or Dr. Feelgood, who treated a lot of the stars.
Yeah. Well, good. I can't wait to read your Jerry Lewis book. What's the time frame on that one?
It's going to be out in next summer in 2021.
Oh,
we've been working on it for 4 years. A fascinating story, kind of a dark story. It's called The Clown That Cried.
The title of his movie.
And I got to know Jerry over the last 20 years of his life, and got to interview him in his Las Vegas office, and interviewed him in San Diego on his boat. And he was an interesting person, you know, and
a great filmmaker.
Of course, he was, you know, kind of associated with everybody from the Rat Pack because of Dean, and he was close to Frank and Sammy himself.
Oh, there's that classic moment where Frank brings them back together
at the Moscow History Telethon, right?
And you know, one of the things, because I'm like you, I love Sinatra, but one of the Sinatra aspects of that reunion that, you know, because people only always see the little clip where they finally bring Jerry and Dean back together. But afterwards, when, you know, you can see that Frank is ready to get back to singing his song. He wants to, Frank wants to, okay, that reunion was fine, but now let me sing.
Right. It, Frank Sinatra was just, he was a professional of all. He was also a great business person, and not highly regarded, but he was one of the sharpest in terms of business among all. Dean Martin ended up very wealthy, but Frank, you know, made sure he had a 9% piece of the Sands. He knew what happened to him in the 50s and how his career fell apart. And he was very, you know, when you look at the Rat Pack and we talk about it in the book, these are actually five middle-aged guys. These are guys in their 40s. So everybody's, you know, portrays them as big partiers and swingers, and Dean's on the stage and they have a bar that rolls on. And Dina Martin said, well, there's always apple juice in Dean. Because, you know, you can't perform.
You know,
unless you're Joey Lewis or somebody like that. Most performers cannot be professional and have your timing. And you know, these guys did two shows a night for 28 days, and they filmed during the day. And if people think they are out playing all night and have girls all over, I mean, I hate to break a myth, but it's sort of like Liberty Valance, you know, print the legend. And that's what it was.
So in your book, Deconstructing the Rat Pack, you are, it's an iconoclastic book in that way, in that you're people have an image that you're destroying, Rick.
Yeah, we're just telling really that this is, it was created. It was like a lot of events that we know in our life, that it was an event that was created for a commercial success. And, you know, there was a book that was made in 1960 that kind of put it out there that Frank, Dean, and Sammy were all out having parties and girls, and Frank ran this club, and it was this misogynistic society. And, you know, we have a picture in the book of Frank and Dean, you know, picketing, you know, about dames. And, you know, it was the last gasp, but it was well promoted and well done. And they played their parts. I mean, Frank, Dean, and Sammy, and Joey, and Peter each had a role and a part, and they played it well.
Well, now, let's talk a little more about Joey Bishop. The things that I remember about Joey, and I think I was aware of him early on because I really loved the show Keep Talking. That was a hilarious
show. That's right.
I remember
Carl Reiner had done it. And
I remember Paul Winchell was also on that show. Mm-hmm. And
Danny Dayton, too.
A lot of funny people were on the show, and I do that. Do any tapes of that show still exist?
I saw a couple that I was able to secure, and there's a couple. There's one that was shot in the East Coast, one was shot in the West Coast. I got to interview Charles Dayton, who's Danny Dayton's son, and Danny Dayton was one of the people who helped create that, and. Danny Dayton told Charlie Dayton told me this great story. His father stole a sign of Joey Bishop's, you know, parking for Joey Bishop, and he kept it for many years at his house, just because, you know, he was irritated that Joey Bishop got the key parking lot spot. Joey had his own set of writers. So Joey had Gary Marshall then, and Gary Marshall's writer partner at the time, Don Sherman, was writing for him. So Joey had these great lines because usually the producers of the game shows would not, in those days, pay for the writers for the panelists. The panelists had to come up with their own material.
Mm-hmm.
And Keep Talking was interesting. I think Joey lasted on the East Coast, and then I don't think he went to the West Coast version. He did a couple on the West Coast version.
And then, of course, he had his situation comedy that we've talked about. But I think, you know, the biggest impact he had was his nighttime talk show on ABC, which was opposite The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. And I thought that was I didn't watch The Tonight Show. I watched The Joey. In those days, ladies and gentlemen, you couldn't watch two things. You couldn't TiVo one and watch it. And if you missed something, you missed it forever. And again, and in the case of The Joey Bishop Show, truly forever, since those tapes don't exist. I can remember the night that The Fugitives final episode aired, and mm-hmm. David Jansen was a guest on Joey Bishop's show by telephone or something like that. But I remember Joey as being very, his show being really delightful and having a lot of good guests. And it had a long run, but I guess not as long as it could have had.
Well, you know, in Joey's case, Joey had every writer he had, he fired. So he had a couple writers, a couple I talked to, and, you know, to last in the Joey's, Regis Philbin told a great story. Regis had taken over for Steve Allen, for the Steve Allen Westinghouse show. Steve Allen himself had got in trouble because a girlfriend of his that Jane Meadow had trailed. The girl found out about it and stabbed Steve Allen with a scissors. And Westinghouse called the morals clause on Steve Allen.
Wow.
So Steve Allen was out. Regis Philbin, who was doing a show in San Diego, was called in to finish the 2 months on Westinghouse. And Joey Bishop had seen Regis Philbin. And when he went to cast the part for the announcer, he called in Regis Philbin. And Regis said, well, why did you choose me? He goes, well, you're a good listener, Regis. So Regis went to a meeting at the William Morris office, where they all sat and they talked about Regis doing it. They said, well, give us a couple hours. So Regis went down to the coffee shop in the building and came back. And in the meantime, they're all saying, you know, Regis is going to try to steal the show from Joey. You shouldn't hire him. He was a host. He's going to try to steal this show. And Joey's getting angrier and angrier. And by the time Regis came back, by the time Regis came back up to the meeting, Joey goes, why would I hire you? And he's screaming at Regis, and Regis going, "Well, Joey, you told me I'm a good listener." And that was it. And it set Regis up to be the sidekick for the next nearly 3 years. But it also set Regis up. It really set Regis back, according to Regis. We interviewed Regis for this book before he passed away.
It's amazing because, of course, I remember Regis, and I first saw Regis, and he came into my life through the Joey Bishop Show. And I thought, you know, what a talentless guy. And yet he went on to become, he holds the record for being on television more than any other human being ever. He overtook another, in my opinion, not so talented guy, Hugh Downs. Those two guys were very bland personalities, but I guess that's what America likes in their...
Regis knew how to be natural in front of a camera. He was a broadcaster. And there's a difference between a lot of people who come onto television. Regis was a natural broadcaster and had done it and was a journeyman by the time he got to the Joey Bishop Show. So he knew how to appear in front of a camera. He wasn't a comedy giant. He wasn't a great singer. He wasn't a performer. But he was like Hugh Downs. Hugh Downs was the sidekick for Jack Parr.
Right. Well, Letterman made Regis very funny, but nobody could make Hugh Downs funny.
Not even Barbara Walters.
I mean, I don't want anybody to think I don't like Hugh Downs or Regis Philbin. They're okay, but they just weren't my.
Yeah, Regis had some interesting. We had talked to Regis, and he really was reluctant to go negative against Joey because he didn't want to be seen as someone who bit the hand that started him. But off the record, and Regis has passed on, Regis had some very tough things to say about Joey. And he said he used to take walks with Joey around the building before the show began. So because Joey just was very pent up and nervous and had this nervous energy. And it's a hard gig to do a talk show for an hour and a half in those days and really carry comedy.
Yeah. I mean, those shows were very different than the Tonight Show of recent years. I mean, the Tonight Show now is, or any of those talk shows are, you know, a 5 minute or 6 minute segments where the host makes jokes as quickly as possible. And then they move on to the next thing. Whereas, you know, certainly with Dick Cavett and Johnny Carson, the last 20 minutes of those shows would be a serious conversation with somebody who'd written a book or something like that.
And Dick can do that. And in Joey's case, ABC was grooming Dick Cavett to take his place. And Joey knew that. So there was Dick had an afternoon talk show on ABC. And then he later had a 10 o'clock at night talk show. And so Joey knew that his days were numbered because Dick Cavett was the fair-haired young boy of the ABC executives.
Yeah. Well, of course, Johnny Carson, a lot of people who have written about Carson, especially his
Henry Bushkin wrote
his book about, you know, saying that he was a narcissist and not a very nice person. And a lot of people say, oh, well, he was very cold and hard to get to know. But Ed McMahon, in his book about Carson, says Carson is the nicest, warmest, most wonderful.
I interviewed Henry Bushkin recently, and Henry had some incredible stories about Johnny, and he got to know him over the years, and including Johnny's breaking into Frank Gifford, to his ex-wife's apartment, and discovering Frank Gifford's picture on Joanne's dresser.
Yeah. Yes. Those are some interesting stories. Well, I can tell you've got a lot more in you to write about. You've written a lot of great books already. I love that Mickey Rooney book.
Thank you.
I love this new book. And I'm looking forward to your Jerry Lewis book. But let's remind everybody that the book we've been talking about is called Deconstructing the Rat Pack, Joey, the Mob, and the Summit. And the author, my guest, Richard Lertzman, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf, Rick.
Oh, thank you, Gary, so much for inviting me again. Mm-hmm.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.